Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Hi, it's Robin Young. Thank you for listening to Here and Now. If you love to listen to your favorite shows, hear your favorite stories, and NPR is your personal connection to the world, keep your love for public radio alive. Visit donate.npr.org/now to give, and then tell the world why you're passionate about listening by tweeting or posting on Facebook with hashtag WhyPublicRadio.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And after a year marked by internal squabbles and legislative setbacks, President Trump and congressional Republicans are ending 2017 unified and celebrating. The president travels to Mar-a-Lago today, having signed into law a $1.5 trillion tax overhaul this morning at the White House.
And all of this, everything in here, is really tremendous things for businesses, for people, for the middle class, for workers. And I consider this very much a bill for the middle class and a bill for jobs.
But Democrats are looking ahead to next year when they are betting that the tax plan's unpopularity will propel them to victory in the midterm elections. Let's get the lay of the political landscape from NPR's Scott Detrow. Hi, Scott.
Hey, how's it going?
It's good. And it's certainly good for the Republicans today. There had been speculation that President Trump would wait until the new year to sign the tax bill in order to avoid triggering automatic cuts to Medicare because of an obscure law known as PAYGO. But that was resolved through the spending bill?
Yeah, that's right. The long answer short is that the government funding bill that just passed waived that language in this case, so it wasn't an issue in the end. And it was clear that President Trump was anxious to close the book on this, to not have any caveats at all, that he couldn't keep his promise to have this tax bill passed by Congress and signed into law by Christmas. He's done that now. It was kind of a hasty signing ceremony in the White House, in the Oval Office. Just one anecdote about how this was kind of thrown together at the last minute compared to how these things typically are. You know, the scene when the president signs a bill and he hands out pens to all the people who played a key role in passage. There were no lawmakers with him, so Trump just started handing out pens to the reporters covering the event. I'm not sure that many of them wanted to take it and claim a role in passing this bill. But,
something for the kids. But when you mentioned that, you know, people are wondering if the T's were crossed, the I's dotted. We're reading about people flooding the phone lines of their local tax assessors at cities and towns. They're trying to pay next year's property taxes now to take advantage of those tax write-offs, which are set to expire. And they're calling their cities and towns, but they're not getting a lot of answers in many cases because people don't know how to handle this. Is that something Democrats are banking on?
Well, I'm not sure that'll be a long-term issue in terms of banking on it to run on that issue, but it's certainly a short-term.
Well, I mean, kind of confusion, you know, or questions about, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just not sure that whether that will be a pressing issue, you know, almost a year from now in the election. But certainly it is an issue a lot of people are facing. And it gets to the fact that President Trump and Republican leaders were so set on getting something to the finish line in 2016 to end the year with a political victory that they rushed through a lot of issues and led to some of the things that you're talking about. And also had to scramble to deal with the government funding and other issues, a lot of which got punted into next year in order to make room for finishing this tax bill.
Right. Well, President Trump also said the tax bill essentially repealed the Affordable Care Act because it zeroes out that, you know, mandate that people buy health insurance. There's no penalty now. But yesterday, Julie Rovner of Kaiser Health News told us that the ACA, Obamacare, is basically intact. And we saw millions sign up for it. So we're wondering, are Republicans going to be able to reap some political benefit by saying they struck a blow at the Affordable Care Act without actually repealing it?
Well, what they've now done is zeroed out the least popular part of the Affordable Care Act. We spent so much of this year seeing just how popular other aspects of the Affordable Care Act are. Expanded Medicaid, coverage, promises of pre-existing condition coverage that you could not be denied health care with a pre-existing condition. A lot of those aspects were the things that really terrified a lot of voters concerned they might lose them. But all along, this mandate has been and remains deeply unpopular. The problem is that so many experts say it's needed in order to ensure that healthy people are on the markets. So I think the question to that is what happens over the next year? Do a lot of healthy people just opt not to buy health insurance? And if that happens, does that drive costs up?
Well, we also will wait to see if what Republicans promise will happen. Here's Speaker of the House Paul Ryan saying that although the tax bill is very unpopular now, that's going to change. He's on Good Morning America. Let's listen.
When people actually see that instead of getting tax increases, they're getting a tax cut, when they see the withholding tables changing in February and seeing more money in their paychecks, when they're seeing the economic growth that will result from historic tax reform, I think minds are going to change, and I think people are going to change their view on this.
Well, and Scott, there's such a disconnect here because we have so many economists who looked at the bill and said that's not going to happen. Is this something that we just have to see how it plays out and which side will win and be able to take that to the midterms?
Yeah, and what will the larger picture look like? What will the economy look like? Will it still be growing at the pace that it grew this year? And the other thing is that while paychecks might change, most people don't get that big picture tax figure until they file their year-end returns, and that would happen in 2019, in early 2019, of course, after the midterm elections. But it's going to be a big campaign issue for sure. It looks like Republicans and Republican-affiliated groups are going to be spending money trying to boost public support for this bill. But we saw what happened in 2010 when Democrats passed a bill that was unpopular at the time, the Affordable Care Act. They said, hey, once this goes into effect, people will love it. It took about 7 years for people to start loving the bill. And in the meantime, Democrats got clobbered in 2010.
Yeah. And we also are looking to see what will happen to other programs, Medicare, or other social programs. Speaker Ryan saying he wants to make some changes. But Mitch McConnell, majority leader, saying maybe not. So we'll see how that unfolds as well. Scott Detrow, who covers Congress for NPR, thank you so much.
Hey, thank you. Congress is gone for the year.
Take a rest.
Yeah.
Well, Apple is now facing class action lawsuits after it admitted this week that it intentionally slowed down older versions of the iPhone. Apple says it has a viable reason to slow down these phones. We'll get to that. Plaintiffs say that Apple engaged in this practice without getting consent from customers. Ben Johnson covers tech for Here and Now. He's also the host of the upcoming podcast Endless Thread. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Jeremy.
And first of all, this is something that a lot of people have suspected for a long time
Oh, yes.
That Apple does this. But how was this discovered?
So it came from some kind of crowd detective work online. Some Reddit users, actually, and developers who work on iPhones noticed that some of the company's older iPhones, like the iPhone 6 and iPhone 6S, really started slowing down recently. So they did a bunch of rigorous techie tests that I won't bore you with. And the takeaway was that, yes, Apple does appear to be slowing down the performance of some older iPhones. As we all know, your phone slowing down is like your worst nightmare, right? And it's a modern challenge. And because this problem with older iPhones slowing down is anecdotally, at least, pretty widespread, people are not happy.
Yeah, I always thought that Apple did it in order to force you into buying the next model of the phone because your phone would be so slow by comparison. But what is Apple saying about this?
So, yes, we'll get to the planned obsolescence part of this. but what Apple's response is that it's a little bit unprecedented, actually, for the company to respond like this. But the company put out a statement essentially saying that, yes, they are doing this. They are slowing performance on phones, but it's for a very specific reason. And the company says that older batteries in older phones are more degraded and can be prone to random shutdowns and other problems when there's a big draw on power. Like if you're using the phone for a lot of processing or you're using the newest operating system for the phone, which may be newer than your phone and thus may require a lot of power. Apple says it's basically protecting the customer from these random phone shutdowns by using an algorithm to manage battery power to manage overall performance and prolong the life of the device.
So what should people be doing if they are feeling like their phone is slower than it used to be?
Oh, man. The age-old question.
Right.
I think this is where it gets kind of interesting because there are some pretty basic logical next steps here, right? You could actually just replace the battery in the phone. And this is what some of these online detectives did in their testing. And they found that their older phones performed much better when they got a newer battery into the phone. Now, of course, this is complicated because Apple makes it really difficult to replace your battery. It's expensive. It's hard. The phone is not really designed to pull the battery out. And Apple is making these decisions without a lot of transparency or input, which is part of the problem here.
So is Apple going to stop doing this phone slowdown thing?
Oh, man. Like, this is something I think about all the time because of this idea of planned obsolescence, right? This idea that the company is purposefully making your older devices worse and bricking them to force you into buying the new thing. And I think that the company really is trying to kind of walk this line of overall making your device work better, but also like making that choice for you instead of letting you make it. Now, this is kind of Apple's modus operandi, right? They make these big decisions for the user in many ways so that you don't have to. And that's why the devices they're less buggy than the competitors. They have less viruses on them. But at the same time, you know, having something that just works is more expensive. So you might have to end up making this decision to buy a new phone.
Didn't Tesla do something like this as well?
Yes. So this is another thing that's like coming to the fore here, right? These companies that make cars, for instance, and are doing software updates over the air that they basically force on their customers, mm-hmm. because it's a safety issue. And Tesla has made these changes for the purpose of, you know, making the car run better, making the battery work better. And users were angry about that too, because again, the user doesn't have the choice. It's the company making the choice for you.
So I guess they can slow down your car if they want to, probably, but maybe haven't
yet. I hope not.
Ben Johnson, who covers tech for Here and Now, thank you.
Thank you.
And I don't care how slow my phone gets, I am not spending $1,000 to buy an iPhone X, at least not yet.
It's been quite a traumatic year, and to close it out, we've been checking back in with survivors of wildfires, shootings, hurricanes. And now we turn to someone they turn to for help and hope. Andrew Enos of Brockton, Massachusetts, works for the American Red Cross collecting blood donations, but he's also a volunteer who gets nothing but a prepaid expense card to travel to disaster zones. And this fall, he went from Texas after the flooding caused by Hurricane Harvey, directly to Florida to help victims of Irma, then to Northern California, where he assisted victims of the October wildfires. Oh, and did we mention Andrew is just 19 years old? He attended Southeastern Regional Vocational Technical High School in Southeastern Mass. He'd hoped to study architecture, but college was out of reach. Now he is rebuilding lives. Andrew, welcome.
Thank you so much.
And I'm looking at you with your beautiful red Red Cross vest on with what looks like all sorts of pins. But just to give people a sense of the trajectory that you were on this past fall. You went from Texas and the hurricane there to Florida. You arrived in Florida as, I think, a service associate for the Red Cross. What happened?
So when I landed in Florida, I got a phone call. It was my deployment person. And she said, Andrew, unfortunately, we have to move you up to supervisor. Congratulations. I'm like, that is unfortunate because I don't know what I'm doing. We got to the Miami office. And they handed me a shelter manager kit, and now I'm shaken because I don't know what I'm doing.
Go from supervisor to manager.
Yeah, so I ended up opening up a shelter at North Miami Senior High School. We ended up getting 950 people into that shelter,
yeah.
And I had four staff. I had another gentleman from Boston and a 26-year-old from Ohio and someone from New York. It's weird because a lot of the people I work with are much older than me. They kind of find it weird to take orders from a 19-year-old, but once we start talking, I'm not a hard supervisor. They understand. I know a lot of the rules for the Red Cross.
How to deal with things. And here you are, 19. Okay, look, we want to hear about managing, you know, almost 1,000 people in Florida and the hundreds that you helped after Harvey in Texas. But how did this all start for you? How did you get involved in the Red Cross?
A lot of people ask me that. Honestly, I just wanted to give back to the community. Mm. It definitely, the Red Cross gave me, it still gives me a lot of opportunities to travel, to see the world, to see the country.
No kidding.
But not just that, it's to give back to these people that are in need.
Well, you started a year ago, November, in other words, two Novembers ago, you started as a volunteer and then you, I understand, work for the Red Cross in the blood bank area.
Yep, I work in the blood services department.
So it's become a job for you. But this flying around, so start with Texas. the enormity of Harvey, the rainfall was record. What did you see?
So when I landed in Houston, it was a day before the storm hit. I ended up spending the night in Yorktown, Texas, and we had about 15 clients that night.
You call them clients?
Clients, yeah.
People were coming to shelters, people without homes. Suddenly you're seeing people who've lost everything. I mean, what was that like to take that in?
It's devastating to see the damage out there. A lot of the family members, they don't know what to do. So you're there to comfort them, really, as much as you can. It's devastating.
It sounds like you're learning a lot on the job, but what do they train you in first aid? Do they train you in management of foods coming into shelters? You're nodding.
Yeah, there's hundreds of trainings that we do. A lot of it is in person. A lot of it's online. Basic food safety, psychological first aid. There's a lot of classes that we take just to be able to deploy.
Did that prepare you for
it did? But psychological first aid helped a lot.
How so? Like, how do you apply that?
That really tells you how to deal with certain situations, how to deal when a client is crying, mm-hmm. What to say, what not to say.
What's not to say? What do you not say?
Like, everything's going to be okay because it's not going to be okay. They just lost everything. They could have lost a family member, and that's difficult for us to work. Can imagine how the family's feeling at that time.
It would be difficult for anyone. You're 19. Have you ever stopped to think? And obviously a couple times you did, like in Florida when you went to Florida from Texas and there's suddenly a shelter manager within minutes. Did you ever think, oh my gosh, I'm in over my head?
Yeah, I actually ended up breaking down a little bit in Florida. At that point, I think I was a little homesick because being home less than 24 hours from Texas to go right to Florida, but then went right back and started working again.
And what was it? What was it seeing, again, people without homes? What was it that...
That was the demand of people coming into the shelter.
900.
I had two colleges at the shelter, and I couldn't fit everybody into that gym. So we ended up opening up a couple hallways in another building to fit them in there.
And you got overwhelmed.
Yeah, I was extremely overwhelmed. I was working 22-hour shifts,
wow.
Sleeping in the hallway on a cot.
Then we're off to the fires in Northern California. Horrible.
Yeah.
What did you see there?
I did a lot of traveling with that deployment, back and forth from Sacramento to Santa Rosa. When we got out to Sacramento, where I landed, they deployed us to Yuba City, and that's where I ran as a casework supervisor.
Wait, so now you're a caseworker supervisor.
Yeah. So I deployed twice as a caseworker and twice as a shelter worker.
And what does that mean, caseworker? What is that?
So caseworkers are dealing with the clients face-to-face, not always face-to-face. We can deploy virtually just on the phone. But I like doing that face-to-face because you get to see what the client's going through. I went out and did outreach. So we were going to the homes and seeing the damage, talking to the clients right there. There was a gentleman out there. He was with probably 9 people digging through the ashes. And as we were talking to him, his wife came over and said they found his wedding ring.
Mm.
So that was really touching. We later found out he was a Yuba City police officer. That was really nice to help him and his family and his daughter.
That's an inspiring moment, a wedding ring, but I'm sure those fires were horrendous. You know what? I mean, I'm thinking of the loss there too, the human loss. What do you offer them?
So we have mental health workers, disaster mental health workers that come out in the field with us. And they're able to talk to the clients a little bit more than we do.
Still to know it. I mean, to know all of this. How do you feel after this fall of everybody was buffeted, but so were you? You know, Texas to Florida to Santa Rosa, Northern California. How do you look back on it?
When I got home, it was a little weird being home because I had a routine out there to go 1 minute from talking to a client every hour on the hour to nothing, to being back home. Collecting blood again. It's a lot different. I enjoy being out there helping these families that are in need. And if that was a job that could pay the bills, I would be out there doing it every day. But unfortunately, I got to work back here at home.
Yeah.
And when I can, I go out there to help.
Well, I'm thinking, you know, at one point you supervised 26-foot-long trucks filled with gear, you know, shovels and cleaning supplies. This is, you know, Corpus Christi, San Antonio area. Another time you're supervising 900 people trying to fit them into a shelter or helping people sift through ashes. do you also find yourself thinking you're 19 years old? You know, you look around at other people and they may be complaining about they don't have a Xbox game, or you're smiling, or do you find yourself thinking, oh man, you don't know problems?
So I had a lot of friends text me, Facebook message me saying, wow, that's amazing. How do you get involved? So a lot of my friends started to get involved a little bit with the Red Cross and different volunteering organizations.
What would you tell people? What is it, you know, why should they? What has it done for you?
It's opened my eyes to a lot of things, to see what these families go through every single day after the hurricanes or wildfires, to know we have everything back home, and to know that they just lost everything, that you could lose everything in the snap of a finger. It's definitely opened up my eyes a lot to things.
I was reading somewhere that you said that was the constant refrain you heard over and over and over from Texas to Florida to Northern California. Never in a million years did I think this would happen to me, someone would say to you.
Yeah. I had a lady in my shelter in Texas. She was there with her sister, and she was an older lady. And we sat down one night. She wasn't feeling well, so she asked for some oatmeal. And it's 11:30 at night. My shift got over at like 11. So we sat down. I was talking to her. We ended up talking for an extra hour and a half. So I was up until almost 12:30, 1 o'clock with her. And she was telling me, not in a million years I would think this would ever happen to me. And she's probably in her 80s, and she was helping her sister that was disabled. And I didn't know what to say to her at that point. There was a little girl in that shelter also, and her name was Callie. She was a 3-year-old little girl. She used to run around the shelter, kicking the ball back and forth with me. On my last day at that shelter, she gave me a colored picture that her and her mom had colored for me, and it was Superman. And every deployment since then, I've taken it with me on, and I carry it with me on every deployment, because it just shows that these families do need you, and they really appreciate everything you do, and I do keep in touch with that family.
And I can see it's a little emotional for you. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, Superman, that's Andrew Enos, a 19-year-old with the American Red Cross who went from Texas to Florida to Northern California. And, you know, what we've learned is he could show up anywhere next. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll post that Superman drawing Andrew carries with him at herenow.org. And by the way, he tells us he's not sure what's next, but hopes soon to head to Puerto Rico to help, and help is needed. More than 3 months after Hurricane Maria, at least a third of that U.S. territory is still without power. The hope had been to get at least 95% back by now, but the Army Corps of Engineers estimates power will not be fully restored until May. Andrew has his work cut out for him. Bitcoin saw a dramatic drop this week, falling as much as 39% after a record high Monday of over $19,000. And today, Coinbase, one of the biggest Bitcoin marketplaces, shut down for short periods. Here for a check-in on the Bitcoin ecosystem is Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. And Mike, do us a favor. How about just one sentence for those just checking in on this? What's a Bitcoin?
Oh, boy, one sentence, that's tough. So Bitcoin is a digital currency that's used around the world, and it's really the first currency that does not have a nation or a central bank backing it up. Mm. And the idea is that, you know, say I cut your lawn for you, Robin, and you want to pay me in Bitcoin. You can pay me without any other third party being involved, in theory, so that it sort of goes around the entire banking and payment system.
Right. But that also means it doesn't have backing. So that's where people get scared. But news this week gave it some more legitimacy. Bloomberg reports that Goldman Sachs will be setting up a trading desk just for cryptocurrencies. And the biggest of those is Bitcoin. So why is that significant?
So this really signals how seriously Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies are starting to be taken by the Main Street financial Wall Street system. And it shows that there really is a large demand from big clients of banks like Goldman, people like hedge funds and institutional investors. And it follows the launch of Bitcoin futures by two of the mainstream exchange companies, CBOE and CME. And CME is where futures for things like crude oil and corn are traded. So otherwise, you have to trade it on a variety of startup exchanges, which have had a lot of technical issues and problems with hackers and so forth. And that had made traditional Wall Street firms nervous. So now it's clear they're getting more and more comfortable with the use of Bitcoin.
Well, hackers are using ransomware and increasingly demanding Bitcoin. Isn't it hard to get? I mean, how are they doing that?
Well, so the very nature of Bitcoin, as I said, allows users to be anonymous and really move money around without using the traditional banking system. So that's obviously very attractive to criminals. At Bloomberg here, we had a really fascinating story this week explaining, since Bitcoin has surged so much in value, it's really emboldened these criminals and caused a massive escalation in demands as far as the dollar value of the demands from hackers who send out ransomware. The story quoted an executive from the insurance company Chubb saying that top payments in corporate ransomware attacks have begun to exceed $1 million. Mm-hmm. And again, Bitcoin is scarce, and that's what's causing the price to go up. But the ransomware people haven't really adjusted their demands. You know, if they previously asked for 10 bitcoins, that's what they're still asking for, even though the dollar value of them has gone up so much.
Well, cryptocurrencies are all very volatile, as we've been seeing. But also, you point out, penny stocks are changing their name to things with Bitcoin in it to scam people. So beware of scams in the few seconds we have.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, scam might be a little bit too strong of a word for some of them. A lot of them are doing nothing illegal. They're simply changing the name of their company. There's a company yesterday, Long Island Iced Tea, which basically makes iced tea, changed its name to Long Blockchain, which is the technology behind Bitcoin. And the stock jumped 183%.
Okay.
So it's crazy.
Long Island Iced Tea. Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And on this Friday before Christmas Eve, we've been talking with Mike Hale, a.k.a. Mike in the Morning, my favorite childhood DJ. He's a general manager at WHMS in Champaign, Illinois. He joins us every Christmas to share some of his favorite Christmas music. Hi, Mike.
Hey, this is great. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. And let's get to some more of the music you brought us today. This is Elvis with Santa Bring My Baby Back to Me.
I don't need a lot of presents to make my Christmas bright. I just need my baby's arms wound around me tight. Oh, Santa, hear my plea. Santa, bring my baby back to me.
Santa, bring my baby back to me.
The Christmas tree is ready, the candles all aglow, but with my baby far away, the good is a mistletoe. Oh, Santa, hear my plea. Santa, bring my baby back to me.
Santa, bring my baby back to me.
This has become a classic, hasn't it?
Yes, it has, and it's been fortunate that there have been a number of artists that have done the studio recreation where they take Elvis on one track and then a current-day singer records with it. This was the brilliance of Colonel Tom Parker. Elvis had gotten to the point that, you know, America was in love with him, and it was his insistence that one side of his Christmas album in 1957 be pop music, and then side two was a religious side with Silent Night, Peace in the Valley, and a lot of songs like that. It was truly an extraordinary recording session.
Okay, well, the next song that we have here is something that people have heard. A lot of people have heard a different version than what we're going to play. This is Santa Baby, but it is from Madonna. This is from 1984.
Santa Baby, slip a sable under the tree for me. Been an awful good girl, Santa Baby, and hurry down the chimney tonight. Santa Baby, an outer space convertible to light blue. I'll wait up for you, dear Santa Baby, and hurry down.
the chimney tonight.
I don't know, Mike. Do you think she holds a candle to Eartha Kitt?
You know what? I think it's a very, very good remake of the song. And it was part of the very special Christmas series that of CDs that were done in the 80s to benefit Special Olympics. And it had so many artists like Bruce Springsteen and Whitney Houston and Sting and Bryan Adams and Bob Seger. In the 70s, we didn't have a lot of artists major artists who did Christmas songs. And it kind of really got everybody, the major artists going in the 80s, to crank out some Christmas songs.
Why did they do it? Why did these artists who are already successful decide to do a Christmas album or a Christmas song?
I think it's because of Special Olympics, and here's an opportunity to raise some serious money for Special Olympics. How can you say no?
All right, well, let's get to another one from the 80s. This is Last Christmas by the English pop group Wham, which is George Michael and Andrew Ridgeley. Christmas. Now, George Michael wrote this song. It has been covered by many artists, including yes. Taylor Swift, who has a version. Why do you think it's been so successful?
You know what? It's an upbeat, sad song. I mean, think about it. How many upbeat, sad songs? I mean, this has got a great beat to it. As Dick Clark would say, you can dance to this particular song.
It's funny. There are many upbeat, sad songs. I'm trying to think of a downbeat, happy song, though. There must be some out there.
And you got to see, have you seen the video on this?
No.
Go on YouTube, take a look at the video, because George and Andrew are accompanying their girlfriends at a ski resort, and there's a cool cable car portion of this, so it's worth checking out the video.
Okay, well, let's go a little bit further back in time now to an old favorite. This is The Christmas Song by Nat King Cole.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose, Yuletide carols being sung by a choir, and folks dressed up like Eskimos. Everybody knows a turkey and some mistletoe help to make the season bright. Tiny tots with their eyes all aglow will find it hard to sleep tonight.
What a classic this is, and you feel like you're sitting in front of an open fire when you listen to it.
The neat thing about Nat King Cole recording this particular song, the original version was done in 1946 in the WMCA radio studios in New York, and it has a magical feeling. Then they put a bigger orchestra behind it in 1953 and sounded even better. And then this recording here is the 1961 recording that was the first stereophonic recording of the song. And it's just between Nelson Riddle and Ralph Carmichael and the musicians that Nat King Cole worked with, it is just... You just feel good when you play that song on the radio.
Okay, well, we have time for one more, and this is Winter Wonderland by Darlene Love.
Like a dream, are you listening? In the lake, so twisting. A beautiful sight, we're happy tonight. Walking in a winter wonderland. Run away, in the bluebird. In the sleigh, in the bluebird. You sing the last song as we go along. Walking in a winter wonderland.
Now, this is a song like many Christmas songs that has been performed by so many people. Frank Sinatra, Johnny Mathis, Ella Fitzgerald, The Carpenters, Bette Midler. Why do you like this one so much, Mike?
It's Darlene Love. It's Phil Spector. Need I say more? This is, you know, Rolling Stone called it one of the 500 greatest albums of all time. Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys says this is his favorite album of all time. And Brian Wilson is a guy who auditioned to be on this particular album and play piano on Santa Claus is Coming to Town. And Phil Spector said, not good enough. Out of here. It's a great album.
You know, here we are listening to these songs and, you know, thinking about all the good things about Christmas. There are a lot of people for whom Christmas is a very difficult time. What would you advise those people, Mike, as somebody who's been playing these songs for so many years?
Pull out the music and listen to it. There were several years that after my mother passed away, who loved Christmas music, there were several years afterwards that I was down in the dumps near Christmas because my mom was not around. And I would pull out Nat King Cole. I would pull out Bing Crosby, Frank Sinatra, Percy Faith. And wow, it just livened up my heart.
That's Mike Hale, a.k.a. Mike in the Morning, my childhood DJ. He's general manager at WHMS in Champaign, Illinois. Mike, thanks so much again for joining us, and Merry Christmas.
Thank you. Merry Christmas to you, your listeners. I appreciate it. Have a good one.
And have yourself a merry little Christmas. No.
And you can find all of our DJ sessions at hereandnow.org.
We wish you a happy, healthy holiday, especially if you're a man, because a researcher has concluded there actually is such a thing as man flu. You know, Ricky Gervais had it. He told Ellen DeGeneres.
You're sick.
No hugs. No, I'm more than sick, Alan. I've got one of the worst diseases on the planet.
Oh, what is that?
Man flu.
Oh.
Really bad.
Yeah. It's different than woman flu?
It's definitely, yeah. When I'm ill, Jane's like Florence Nightingale. She's on me all the time, helping me. When Jane's ill, I don't know about it. She gets up, she goes to the doctor, she's back before I'm up. You know what I mean? But when I'm ill,
yeah.
Everyone knows about it.
Yeah.
I don't think I'll make Christmas.
Oh, no.
Yes, this idea that big, strong men fall like giant sequoias when they get the flu, while women get food on the table, juggle kids and work, maybe only taking a break to mop a brow when the fever breaks. But in the December edition of the medical journal BMJ, Canadian researcher Kyle Su of Memorial University of Newfoundland says this is unjust. Men are more likely to die from the flu, be hospitalized for it, and it could be that while women have higher levels of the hormone estradiol, which can boost the immune system, men have more testosterone, which can suppress it. They might be sicker.
See, that's what we've been saying all along, Robin.
Okay, I believe you. All right, some shopping malls across the country will be packed this weekend. Others, not so much, as chain stores leave because of online competition. That's what was happening to the St. Lawrence Central Mall in Messina, New York, until residents had a plan. North Country Public Radio's Lauren Rosenthal has that story.
I've been dropping in on the St. Lawrence Center Mall for months now, and usually it's a ghost town. I might see a few people clustered in the JCPenney, but never anything like this. It's a Saturday afternoon in early December, and young families are lined up around the corner to meet Santa Claus. Older couples are walking the halls, peeking into new storefronts.
We were surprised because when we first moved in, you could have rolled a bowling ball down the center of the mall and not hit a soul, ever.
That's Pat McCowan, one of the co-founders of the North Country Showcase. It's basically a co-op for local art, funded by lots of small local investors. Since they opened their shop in the mall last summer, close to 90 crafters have signed on to sell their work.
Bowls and cups and quilts and mittens.
Then came the rustic porch swings and chainsaw carvings of bears. McCowan says the store quickly ran out of space and moved into a huge showroom at the center of the mall.
We have one employee. The rest of us still volunteer. And we're not young chickens. So things happen to us, and we're sidelined, and then we come back. And we believe that we're creating an economic development climate.
That's something Messina used to get from factories and multinational corporations. Their workers spent tons of money in this mall. Now, most of those jobs are gone, and people are realizing the big factories probably aren't coming back. Customers Steve and Robin Boutot say it took a long time to accept that.
You can't just snap a finger and bring another big, huge manufacturing business back into the locale. It's you got to plug away at 100 job businesses, 50 job businesses, 20 job.
It's exactly. Take little steps.
Yes, we do.
And I think this North Country Showcase is one of those steps.
Small, locally owned shops are everywhere in the mall these days. Lenny Nesbitt recently took an empty Sears store and turned it into a winter wonderland. I notice a globe suspended from the ceiling, wrapped in a holiday wreath.
This is wild.
Christmas around the world. A wreath around the earth. Where do we come up with the ideas, right?
Nesbitt has projects in three storefronts throughout the mall. He's one of its biggest supporters and says he's been feeling hopeful ever since a real estate firm purchased the entire property last winter.
The parking lot is fully lit now. You know, the halls are all relit. And these were things that were just to the wayside with the last company. I think if we say over the next 5 years, if we can just keep making improvements, I think that we'll see a good drive in the economy here.
But not every shopkeeper can wait that long. Once the Christmas season ends, traffic in the mall is going to go back to normal. And at the end of January, the Bon Ton, one of the last remaining anchor stores, is going to close. Amanda and Scott Earle told me they drove more than an hour with their infant daughter this month to visit the mall for one reason only.
We didn't know what was open, what stores were here at all. We only knew that Santa was here. That's just about it.
Yeah. And I kept saying, what a sad mall. Like, I know it's going to be a lot of closed stores.
Until there's a Target or a Marshalls, the Earls say they won't have a reason to come back. Most malls still rely on big stores to pull in customers. That way, there's someone there to visit the smaller shops. St. Lawrence Center doesn't have those anchor stores. If the mall did go under, Nesbitt says people like him would probably be fine.
Oh, boy. It wouldn't affect my business because I'm an event planner and a lot of my business is outside the mall. Emotionally, it would be very hard to say goodbye to this place. It's like home to us. It's like home to our family. We're a local business and we're in the mall, so it's our home.
It's a major reversal that St. Lawrence Center could look and feel less like suburban sprawl and more like the heart of a town. For Here and Now, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
Fingers crossed. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Merry Christmas. Mm-hmm. Happy holidays. It's Here and Now.